I pay all the taxes that are legally required and not a dollar more.
Candidate Mitt Romney speaking last night at the debate in Tampa, Florida. I pay all the taxes that are legally required and not a dollar more. Well, it doesn't necessarily settle the matter, but that's what the candidate, former Governor Mitt Romney, has insisted all along. And after weeks of ham-handed ambivalence and some hesitation, he has finally released his tax returns for the past 2 years. Call them silver bullet points. Romney has assets of $250 million, which pays him a nice, tidy $45 million income, $22.5 million per year. He paid about $6 million in taxes for the two-year period and gave away about $7 million in charitable contributions over the same period, including $4.1 million to the Mormon Church, of which he's a member. His tax rate, calculated according to these documents, is 13.9%. Romney clearly pays his taxes, but the story told in these documents is of a man who is wealthy enough to never have to work again, whose tax rate is far lower than equivalent wage earners because he's taxed at the basic capital gains 15% rate before any deductions. Perhaps the takeaway from these tax returns is just how rarefied the financial world of Mitt Romney turns out to be. Joining us is Benjamin Wallace Wells, contributing editor for New York Magazine. He's author of an article, The Romney Economy, about Romney's time in the financial world. Benjamin Wallace Wells, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, forgetting the math for a moment, just how unique is this world in which Mitt Romney lives? Financially speaking, economically speaking, compared to the rest of Americans, I mean, is he in something of a bubble?
I think he is. There's something insular, not just about his degree of wealth, but about the private equity world in which he made it. Remember that a private equity principal, unlike a CEO, doesn't have very many responsibilities to public groups. He doesn't have a group of shareholders that he's a broad group of public shareholders that he's responsible to. He doesn't have to deal with labor unions. Most of his conversations are with a very small group of very wealthy investors, institutional and personal, whose perspective on the world is very much like his. When I was reporting this story, there were friends and allies of Romney's, Tom Stenberg, the founder of Staples, probably principal among them, who would give me these anecdotes that were, you know, designed to show what a man of the people Romney could be, you know, when he was out at Staples around the country, how personable he was in when he would, you know, interact with regular employees. But the truth of the matter is that was a very small portion of his time in his whole career in the private world was spent doing things like that. It's a private equity is a pretty small and pretty insulated world.
You know, I don't want to get into a sort of predictable criticism of private equity. I mean, Newt Gingrich has done plenty of that in his commercials. But I don't necessarily feel any sympathy for Mitt Romney, but there, he must have to use a lot of discipline to keep from making these kinds of statements. Listen.
To also tell my story, I'm also unemployed.
Are you on LinkedIn?
Yes, actually. And I'm networking.
Good job.
I've been doing my
a lot better than what we've done.
but I have my son at a particular job I'm working for, so I know exactly what I'm aiming.
Now, that's Mitt Romney speaking with job seekers at a coffee shop in Florida, probably not unlike the Staples that was described in the anecdotes in your story, trying to sort of bond with these people, saying, hey, I'm unemployed too. I mean, does he really believe that not having to work because you make $21 million a year is a form of unemployment?
I can't imagine, and I'm sure David Axelrod is sitting in Chicago right now just rubbing his hands together in glee. I think what's happened with Romney here sort of personally and psychologically is he has never really had to defend his wealth. And so he doesn't have a very good language in which to do it. And so he ends up resorting to these kind of awkward jokes and mismatched comparisons between him and his audience because he hasn't spent, you know, 15 or 20 years to defend it, developing a political language to respond to this. In the 2008 presidential election, when he didn't make it beyond the Republican primary, he was rarely attacked for this. When he was running for governor, he was taken completely by surprise by attacks on his Bain Capital record. This is just a guy who has not had the kind of experience that one would expect from a candidate at this point in his career in defending his record and in making his case. And I think that that's part of the reason why you see this this sort of stiffness and awkwardness around the topic.
Would you say that the moments like this, and of course there's the famous one at the Iowa State Fair where he said, corporations are people too, my friend, and, you know, describing his situation. And again, you know, there's an economically valid argument there, but it's just not the kind of thing that, you know, someone who doesn't make $45 million over the last 24 months would necessarily say. Do you think this smacks of that anecdote of George H.W. Bush not really understanding what a shopping scanner seemed to be, and the conclusion there was that he hadn't shopped in, you know, 10 years or so?
Maybe a little bit. I think there's something deeper happening here, too, that's worth pointing out. The surprise to me is not that these issues have emerged in the campaign. It's that they've emerged with such potency during the Republican primary. You know, there's been this sort of subterranean rift in the Republican Party going back over a quarter of a century. Its rhetoric has been deeply populist, and yet in its policies and principles, it wants to venerate free enterprise and the processes by which, and sort of idealize the processes by which extreme wealth is built. And right now, Republican voters are sort of faced with the enactment of all that. You know, here's the personification of somebody who has really, and you know, if you look at his record at Bain Capital, I mean, this is a guy who is an idealist about what capitalism could do and what the markets could do, and who used his own brain and his own analytic techniques to really make companies more perfect economic units, and was extremely successful at it.
And his argument is, before we go, that you know, this is how wealth happens. It's what I do, and I'm just a rich guy who's successful, who can lead this nation, and who pays his taxes. Except, as we're demonstrating here in this conversation, the release of those tax returns does not settle the matter. Benjamin Wallace Wells, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Wells is a contributing editor to New York Magazine. You can find a link on thetakeaway.org to his discussion and exploration of the rarefied world of Mitt Romney.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.